So yeah, I just gave a talk this morning about my science and also my instrumentation project, but I prepared something very different for this colloquium today, the EDI colloquium. About 2 months ago, there was a meeting organized at the Hamilton about Indigenous astronomy, and I was invited there as a speaker, and most of the people actually that registered for this conference were people from the First Nation around Canada, really like a lot of different communities. And we exchanged there about the knowledge about astronomy of our community. And it was great. So I'm inspired this presentation today from what I had prepared for them. So it will be very different than the typical talk that you are supposed to, or that you're used to hear. And I will try to actually keep them as authentic as it was when I talked to them, just because I think it's good for you to be exposed to that kind of information and talks. And it is about rediscovering our knowledge. That's how I named it. But it's a little bit about my journey into the rediscovering the knowledge of my community about astronomy. So there's a lot of personal information into this, and it's also part of it. It's meant to be like that. So I'm going to share a little bit of that with you. If it triggers something, if it makes you think about something and you want to share something with me, it's like if I'm having a conversation with you all. We're in a big room. But if you want to have a personal conversation with me about some things that you might find interesting, please do so. It's just about learning from each other. I'm from the Innu Nation, which has multiple communities across the Quebec province. It's about the same latitude as the Cree here in Ontario, and there's also a lot of Cree communities in Quebec. And my community is called Pequot-Kamilnuats, which means basically the Innu that lives by the Deep Lake. Our reservation is by the Lake St. John in Quebec, and it is a very deep lake. Its name in the Innu community is Pequot-Gami. The pictures that I'm showing you here are from our hunting camp, which is farther north from the lake, so that's the lake right here. Masayat is also another name from our community. That's the camp that my family built in the middle of nowhere. By all means, our closest neighbor is probably 25 kilometers away from there, and they're usually not there at the same time as we are. And we go there to hunt moose in September, and I spent the last 6 years in Hawaii, and in September, I was taking all of my vacation from the year, and I was going hunting with my family, because that's a really dear and important moment that I love. And these photos show the wonderland, the place where everything can happen, and it's beautiful. There's blueberries everywhere, so you're never hungry. And the bears are also well-fed, which is a good thing. The land of my community is shown here on this map. It's absolutely a fantastic website if ever you have the chance to go check. It shows all of the different native territories across America. And I like it, actually, across the globe. And I like it because it shows also the overlaps between the territory. You know, boundaries are not something modern. territories were meant to be overlapping in between communities. And what is special about my community is that it spans a lot of different latitudes from north to south. Typically, community members would have a summer camp further south, believe it or not, and then a winter camp further north. I know it's like, you would think it would be the contrary, because that's what people do nowadays, the snowbirds go south during the winter. But it was the contrary back then, and there was a reason for that. First of all, you want to be out of the woods when the mosquitoes arrive in the summer. But also, you want to follow the animals where they are in the winter for the hunt, on the fall and the winter. When I was younger, I lived closer to Quebec City. I was outside of the reservation, but I moved on. I went to that reserve when my dad ended up meeting his then girlfriend, which is also a a First Nation from this community, the Wendat community. And so I lived part of my life in this community, and that's when I grew more and more interested about the culture and the aspect associated with this part of my identity. But I've been taught things in a Western way most of my life, except from the hunting, which was a very important part of what my dad was trying to transmit to me as part of our culture. And that's just a map showing the different treaties. It's just to mention that basically most of the territory is in an unceded land section of our country. The reserve where we hunt is called Ashuapmushuan. It's an Innu word that means where we go wait for the moose. Very clever name. And indeed, we wait for the moose because you cannot really follow them efficiently in the woods, at least the way the woods were back then. And I'm showing all of these pictures because when I was young, I was taught to look at all of the details that I could use from the environment to be a better hunter, to understand better how everything was interacting, from the weather to the moon cycles to the way plants are growing and the animals, their food, their habit. And it made me an extremely good observer of details. And I'm actually using those skills nowadays as an observer. It's just I'm looking up at the sky. And sometimes you make nice discoveries. This is an arrowhead I found in the lake. I have a very, very long story about that, probably 2 hours, so I'm going to skip it for today. But just to say that it made me aware of the environment. And that's a picture of me just after getting a moose. It was my first moose by myself. I didn't put any picture of the moose, don't be worried. But it's just so that you see the landscape and what it looks like. And also how hard it is to actually be part of this. I graduated in 2017 out of a group of very diverse people. And since it's an EDI talk, I wanted to highlight this. So this is my supervisor, Carmel Robert. She was the only woman of the department, the astronomy department at Laval University. So it made my my way into graduate study much smoother because I felt like I could tell her anything, that she would listen to me and value my opinions. And so it facilitated me planning for projects and having my own idea and being really independent in my research. Those other students were also PhD students at the same time. You have some from Burkina Faso, Morocco, and France. And so I always felt accepted in that group, and that made a huge difference for me to go through graduate schools like this. And then I was hired at the Canada-France Hawaii Telescope and sent to Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right over there. We often forget our planet is mostly an ocean, so I like to put that picture on. And it's in the middle of the ocean, and I'm mentioning that because when I was in Hawaii, I learned about the local culture, the native Hawaiians, also that art were there, their perspective on the sky, and it also made me grow as a scientist. It made me grow a different perspective on how we do our science, where we build our facilities, the way we also think about the future of our facility and their sustainability, the way they affect the communities around, and how we can do it better. So I've learned a lot about that. And it's just a few images, because normally I would talk about this science, and here I'm showing a picture of a Hawaiian canoe in the ocean. When I was there, I spent probably a tenth of my time on the ocean, and I was paddling, and you'll see why I'm mentioning that. It'll be relevant later in my talk. So on a normal talk, I would talk about the science that we do there, all the technical aspect of it, and I think that the way we present science, the way we talk about science is often a little bit disconnected from the way people can hear it and understand it. So I'm still going to mention what would normally be in my talk. I would talk about instrumentation, very technical aspect of it, about the people that are involved in developing those instruments, and how stars are forming in the universe, and how this is so important in understanding physics of those regions, and also their context in the universe, broadly in galaxy, but also as a mechanism to transform our universe. And I like talking about that, but sometimes when we talk about astronomy and we disconnect it from the day-to-day life, it's harder for people from the community to really connect to it as well. So today, I'm going to change it. I'm going to talk about astronomy from a very connected perspective and a personal perspective. So in 2017, I started working in Hawaii, and there was an eclipse that year. And someone sent me an email saying, "Lori, can you talk about eclipses as a First Nation? What are the different stories related to the eclipse and the knowledge associated with that from your community?" And when I got that email, it kind of shocked me because I had no idea what to say. I had no knowledge about eclipses from my community. Should I? Probably. Why I don't have any knowledge about this? And this all started to bubble. It's like a snowball. It started to grow in me. So I told that person, "I cannot answer you today, but I will answer you tomorrow." And I started to use my connection, talk to people, and gather some information to be able to say something about connection between eclipses and my First Nation perspective. And then, for someone who doesn't like history, I've never liked history, probably for other reasons, I started reading books about my community. I started to talk to people, go back in time, gather information. There's no astronomy book from communities. It doesn't exist. So if you want to learn the knowledge, you have to really dive in. So this simple request from a collaborator started this whole process for me. And then I suddenly started to connect things that I was reading with my own experience in life while I was hunting with my dad. And it made me feel like I was part of something. What are the techniques to use to find your path and to rediscover your knowledge? I was trying to present something like a structure for this talk today. So there will be the first section about know where you start. And it's inspired by some teachings from my dad about how to not get lost in the woods. Look for clues, all of the clues, and use all of the available information that you find to picture what is the knowledge, what is actually this knowledge that is slowly being lost, by the way. And keep your mind open to any information, source of information you can get, and make those connections. So that's how I started. When you're in the woods, I think I have a, I'm just gonna go back here. So when you're in the woods, often you wander around and you hear a noise and suddenly you wanna leave the main path and go see what it is about that you heard. And you're gonna end up very quickly in a very dense area and you can't really have any elements of the nature that helps you locate yourself. So what you do is every few steps that you do, you turn around, you look behind, and you try to notice little things that you will remember. It could be a rock, a branch, a mushroom, anything that is there. And your brain is kind of magically built to remember those patterns. And you continue your way, and again, you turn around and you look for those patterns, signs, a tree that is a little on the side, and you continue your way. And you do that because once you're done looking for whatever you heard, this is what you're gonna see. And if you haven't looked many, many, many times behind, you will be completely lost. Okay, so I started with books, like I was mentioning. I read a couple of books from my community, but sometimes there's not much information. So also from the Cree, which are close to the Innu because of their latitude. I also watched some archive videos, the few of them that are existing, of people trying to explain how they use the sky, to travel large distances, but also to hunt, find their camp, and things like that. I read some theses that were available, some in French, some in English. That one was particularly helpful because they were interviewing people of one of the community of the Innu nation that was the farthest north, so the most isolated one that didn't have many contact with the colonizer, basically. So they were a little bit more preserved in what they knew. And then another one here, again in French, but from Ottawa, closer from here. And this one was also talking about another community farther north in Trout Lake from the Cree community. They were making connections in between the knowledge. So I gathered a bit of information here and there. And I also talked to elders from my communities. This is just a couple of examples. Josephine Bacon is a poet from the Innu community. She writes books in both the native language and French. Poesy is extremely important in the Innu community. Everything is kind of based on the beauty of the nature, and the way they also express themselves in the language is extremely poetic. And you have to grasp that if you're about to start reading stories, because the information is also embedded in art. So that's how I could like explain it. And she was also mentioning to me that back in the days, people would travel extremely large distances at night because the winter are long, and the night are also extremely long during the winter. And so most of the day, they would be walking in the woods in complete darkness, and they knew so well the woods that they could even recognize the trees by the shape of their head, like it was faces. So they could just go along and see the faces of the trees against the night sky and know where they were. Another thing that is important to understand is the context of a community is also their spiritual belief, especially in astronomy. A lot of the people from Turtle Island believe that we come from the stars, and this kind of all of those spiritual beliefs were inherently connected to that. So just to give you a little glimpse of what it is in my community, and it's a beautiful philosophy. I kind of want to call it a philosophy more than a religion. For my community, there's two parallel worlds, one on Earth, one, I want to say in the sky, but it's not in the sky. It's like a parallel world associated with the stars. You have a person in both worlds, and your physical presence on Earth is just temporary, but the other one always lives. So you never die. Like, that is not really something. And through your dreams, you can access that other person. They call it the Mistapeo, or the great man, your great man. And you can connect with yourself in this other parallel world to get guidance, to do the right things in life. That other person is like in the stars, in this parallel world. And when you die, you go back there, and you're part of this kind of knowledge, this knowledge base that is kind of always there from generation to generation. And so this idea that we come from the stars is different from each community, but often it is related to something close to that. They're also having the concept of animal masters, which I love, because there's even like the master of mosquitoes. There's a master for everything. I can understand why there would be a master for mosquitoes. They are really powerful. but there's also the master of the farts, believe it or not, and very important. It's like the old microbiome, you know, is into the stories of the fart master. There's a lot of science in it. And there's also the caribou master, which is also very important. I'm going to show you one first story. I'm going to try to resume it. It's a story that I read about how Wolverine, a very powerful animal, It's like they're tricksters. It knows both good and bad. It does like stupid things sometimes, but it's clever. And it's how he created the world. And it's like a twisted version of Turtle Island from the Innu community. They are, like my community is, I would say if I had to describe them, they're always laughing and making jokes, cracking jokes constantly. Some of them are a little bit scatologic, like the fart man things. But it is absolutely hilarious. And when I read those stories, I recognized that in my on my dad's side of the family a lot. And so this story says basically that back in the days, there was a flood. And Wolverine was just tired from jumping from rocks to rocks. There was only just a few rocks and ocean. And so he asked all of the animals to help him gather some dirt to build something more solid, because he was just tired of it. And Muskrat eventually came out of the bottom of the water with something, and he blew in his back to get the dirt back out. And it's kind of, it's meant to be funny. It's meant to be saying at the same time, it probably arrived, didn't happen exactly like that, but that's what we say. And there's some kind of peace to it. I like it, because we don't really know how the world was created. But back in the days, there must have been more water, and something then happened, and we had more ground. And then, that's why I have a little reminder there. I have to go on my other software, because I want to show you something. Because out of my reading, I knew that the Wolverine is a constellation for my community. I could identify that. It's Orion, or the equivalent of what Orion is. And this is Orion in the sky. From about the latitude of Sept-Îles, so Saint-Laurent River, close to that. This is the south. And I'm just going to move in time very quickly. I don't know if you see that, but this is the Wolverine going up the horizon and down, jumping from rocks to rocks. And if you'd be on the Saint-Laurent River, you would see it going above the ocean. So in that simple story that might be, you know, very light, there's something about the sky. And that's just the beginning of what I discovered when I was reading those stories. So if you don't believe me with that one, you'll believe me with the next one. So back in the days, winters were extremely important because it was the harshest period of the year, the most dangerous one. A year was not described by like the sun. It was mostly either one winter or 12 or 13 moons. The people would say, how many winters are you in the language? To ask how old are you. The time for displacement would be also expressed in nights instead of days. And they would also count hours and distances with the stars. Like, I will be back when this star will touch the horizon. It's like a way to calculate time. Also, I found in the language many, many more things. That's just an example. Here is Kujuak. It's an Inuit village up north. Very hard to get there, but you could sometimes in the winter, in the summer, when everything melted. And if you would reach the water basin that goes down those river, you could reach Kujuak from the Innu territory. And people were doing it. And the name for Kujuak in Innu is Washkaikan, which means the circle that we follow while dancing. Why is that? So I'm going to show you another thing. Oh, yeah, I think I have it in the slides, yeah. So that's a little video. I hope it's going to start. Oh, it didn't work. Well, for some reason, that's not working. Okay, I'm just going to tell you what works, but it's beautiful. So when you're in Kujuak, the motion of the sun in the summer is actually making a circle in the sky. So there's no night, sun never sets, and it goes like this. So you have no reference to know where you're going. Stars are not there, and the sun is just going round and round and round. And so if you would follow it on a path. You'd go in circle. And I found it beautiful and poetic that the name of the place, again, yet again, is explaining this very important phenomenon, celestial phenomenon. Okay, the moon also is a good reference. So 12 moons, but so the year, a full year is 365 days. That's how we use it every day in the Gregorian calendar. How would we do that with moons when some years has 12 moons and some years have 13? Because the cycle, the moon cycle is about 29 and a half days. So it's not a full integer to make a year. So when I read about it, I was trying to find what was the calendar. There must have been a way. Everybody has a calendar. And so I found in the information an informant that mentioned something very special. She said there was a period during the year where the time would stop for 10 days. And that's the beginning of the year. That's it. That's the only information he has. Whoa, mystery right there. I'm already digging in. What could that mean? What are those 10 days? So I'm going to give you two interpretations of what that could be. Maybe it's both. I don't know. But if you calculate 12 moon cycles, there's 11 days missing to get a full year. And if you are calculating from new moon to new moon, which is normally what they would do, then you have your extra one day. and you get 365 days. But then there's another phenomenon that happens in the sky, and I'll show you what it is. Something that we can observe very easily, and I'm gonna go in December at noon. So here we are, December at noon, and let me, yes. So right now I'm moving from days to days and I'm keeping the time at noon. So we see the position of the sun in the sky at noon. When it gets to the winter, it goes very low to the horizon, right? The closest point to the horizon, and then it goes back up for the summer. And in June, it's all the way up high. And I want you to notice that the sun seems to stop in the sky right there. Whoa. Well, you don't count it here, but it's about 10 days. And so, that's what they were using to track the year. Either 12 moon cycles plus 10 days when it would stop before you start to recalculate again, or the sun stops in the sky for 10 days and then the year starts again. So I was so excited when I found that because it's zero knowledge you can find anywhere. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm the only one on the planet that knows. I need to tell everybody, this is great. I wish that someone would have told me about those calendars before when we hear about all of the other ones when we're taught in school. So I don't know if you're excited about it. I was. my clicker doesn't work. Let me just, oh yeah, I have to go back to my presentation. So there was this other one. And the moon in my community is associated with a very important character in stories, which is called Tsakepesh. You might have seen that name. There's now like TV shows for kids about Tsakepesh because he does all of these things. He's a shapeshifter. He has like superpower, but he's also the man on the moon for my community. And so that's also a relevant thing that I'm going to use for other stories later. Okay, a couple of words. A star in Innu is Uchakatak. A spirit is Achak. So they kind of goes together. A star is like a spirit. The Milky Way is the path of the dead, Tipei Meshkano, but it's also associated with the summer birds and the migrating birds. Why is it associated with the birds? Let's go check it out. So going back into my software, I'm gonna go where during the year the birds are migrating. So around April, more or less. And I'm gonna set it up early in the morning, right there. So I don't know if you guys see the Milky Way very well on the contrast. Let me just go back a little bit. Okay, there it is. See, right here? South, north. On the morning just before the sunrise, when the birds are migrating, the Milky Way is aligned north-south. just pointing the way for the birds to go back. And that's the same, actually, if you go in October, 6 months later, for the other migration. So I'm just going to tune it back and go, yeah, a couple of minutes before. There we go, north, south. So that's why it was associated with it, for the community as a pointer of the migrating path. Oh, and there's a beautiful story also, because the wolverine one day was in love with someone and didn't work out the way he wanted, and he was so frustrated that he wanted to destroy the world that he had made, and he decided to dig out the dirt and put it back in the sky. And that's what built the Milky Way. And I found it very interesting because it's talking about dust, and it's very rare that in communities they refer to dust instead of stars. And we see all those dark clouds of dust in the Milky Way at night, just to mention. So I was on something. I was following a track. Like, I felt like there must have been even more than that, but I was digging pieces and parts of information. And like I was saying, you have to use all of the available information that you gather and then try to make sense of it. One thing that I also want to convince people about those stories is that they are really old, and they gather information from generation to generation. And one of the best examples of that is the Seven Sisters. You might have read about it. I think it was in the news like a couple of years ago. But since the Seven Sisters is a story that is very common around the globe, from India, China, America, people were thinking it has to be an old story because everybody shared the same basis for it. There's some differences, but it is all about the Pleiades. And the Pleiades, when you look at it in the sky nowadays, it actually has six stars, not seven. But all of the stories talk about seven stars. And it is actually due to the fact that one of them got hidden behind one because of its proper motion. So that seventh star is now hiding behind one of the six. And most people don't see it anymore. But it took about 100,000 years for that star to be hiding. So is it because that story is 100,000 years old? Maybe. And I'm saying that to you because I'm going to present you a story from my community, and it is also shared with other communities in Canada. And I want you to believe that that story is tens of thousands of years old. That's what I believe. Tens of thousands, because if it was more than that, then the large constellation, like the Big Dipper, for instance, would be so different in the sky that we wouldn't recognize it, because the stars have proper motion. So this is just, and my videos are not working. Sorry. Check. This is strange. Why are all the videos not working? Is it the first time it happens here? I've never had that happen before. The file is there. Okay, well, it's okay. No worries. Believe it, believe me on my words when I say that about 30,000 years ago from now, the Big Dipper looked fairly similar to what we know of it today. This beautiful structure here is very, very similar. But if you go hundreds of thousands of years and millions of years, then Big Dipper is not in the sky anymore. So there's a limit to that. Okay. So we're going to go back to the age of the interglacial period, where we had mammoths on the land. And I'm going to take you to Tsakapesh, because there's a lot of stories in the Innu community about Tsakapesh and those monsters. And why do we know it's mammoth? Because in the stories, it's not like they like specifically mention the same name. They have like a name for those monsters, but it's not mammoth. But they describe their characteristics, and they say basically that they had teeth that were long enough to pierce the body of seven men, that they had long legs, and that they had to literally go and lay on the trees like this at night so that they wouldn't fall. Because if they would fall on the ground, then they couldn't go back up. And they were really dangerous. And so Tsakapesh has multiple stories with them, including the story when he was born. And he was the one responsible for killing the last one of them. I found it extremely appealing, you know, that there's a recollection of these interactions in the stories. And also find it extremely funny when I read articles that say the woolly mammoth may have started the landscape of first human in New England, like from extremely actively active research, when those stories are actually saying the same thing for thousands of years anyway. it's the way it is. And also the arrowhead that I found in the lake right behind our camp was roughly dated by someone that is specialized in dating those to about 4,000 to 8,000 years, which is like pretty impressive, which was bring us back to close when they were extinct, actually about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. Okay, the big constellation. There's a big constellation that I was able to identify in my community because it is composed of two main spirits, the Wolverine, Orion, Oquequechu, and the Big Dipper, which is Uchek, or the Fisher Cat. It's a small animal. So I knew that there was this constellation in the sky, and I kept reading a story about Uchek, the Fisher, and the Wolverine, or sometimes it was the Wolf. They're kind of close by. I was reading stories about them all over the place. And one of them was really long and extremely linked to the seasonal changes. And I was able to connect it to the motion of those constellations in the sky, and I'm going to show it to you. So from that thesis, I knew those constellations were right. They were like my anchor to base this idea. And I took one version of this story, which is a story that is called The Story of the Summerbirds. There are versions in the Cree community, version in the Anishinaabe community. Many, many communities across Canada have a version of that story. So probably very old, right? And it always starts in the same way, a long, long time ago in an eternal winter, or the interglacial age. Well, that's what I think. And there's a version that is online, if you want to go and look at it. I think it's also subtitled in English. And I'm going to give you a very short version. So a long, long time ago, there was this little boy. He had met his Mistapeo, but his Mistapeo had to leave, and he was extremely sad and was crying and crying. And he was like, it was impossible to calm him. And so all of the forest were like, oh my God, this child is so impossible. Is he gonna ever stop? And they gathered together and they asked him, what can we do for you? And the child said, I wanna be able to hunt the summerbird. And then people were like, this is impossible. The summerbirds, like, we haven't seen them in forever. And I think they are like stuck in a village that is called the Summer Village, because back then the summer was a place and not a season. And there's a guy that keeps them in a cage there or a bag. And so we have to organize an expedition and go get them. And we don't even know where to start. So they gather the most courageous one, the fisherman, the fisher cat, and the Kwekwetsu, the Wolverine, are part of the team. And they go down and eventually end up on a canoe going south to the summer camp. And once they reach there, eventually a lot of things happen. They end up catching the birds. And the man who was keeping the bird prisoner started to chase them with an arc and a bow and an arrow. And Uchek, the fisher cat, in an extreme sacrifice, jumped on the shore. And he tried to lure the man away from the birds and his friends and Kwekwetsu. And he goes up a tree, all the way up. And the man aims at him with his arrow and kill it. But when the arrow touched the fisher cat, it is pushed into the sky and stays there, and it is what is used for his friend to find their way back to the North. And we know how the Big Dipper or the Fisher Cat is used to find the North Star and also find the North. And the friends go back to their path, they free the bird, and the birds bring back with them the heat and the warmth. And then there's a deal that is made that the birds will spend 6 months to the North and 6 months to the South, and the seasons were back to the North. So it's a season, it explains the return of the season after the glacial age with the constellation. And so I'm gonna show you a little bit. I think I have like, so that's the art version of the Fisher here with the little arrow in the constellation. And we're gonna see what it looks like in the sky. And I think I had a video, but it's not gonna work. So let's go with the app. Okay, so Orion is Kwikwetu. Big Dipper is the Fisher. And we're gonna go on the solstice of the winter, the coldest period of the year, so 21st of December. And I'm gonna take you right after sunset. Okay. So here is sunset. Sun is setting. What appears on the horizon is the canoe laying flat on the horizon with Fisher on one side and Kwikwetu on the other. As the night goes, the canoe is gonna align itself from north to south like this, north to south. And as it continues to go, the Fisher is gonna climb up to the zenith and go in that tree all the way up, close to be right on top of your head. And at that point, we can still see here Kwikwetu on the horizon, and the summer bird, the Milky Way, is still aligned north-south at that moment. Isn't that beautiful? Anyway, if it's a coincidence, I find it extremely, extremely well, you know, entangled with the story. So I hope that now you believe me when I say that this story is actually explaining the motion of the stars, and it's a form of art, and it's trying to explain physical changes of the environment with what was observed. And since the constellations are always there, they're a way to trigger your memory. It's something you constantly see. So if someone tells you the story and points at it in the sky, you will know this story for the rest of your life. And it will be above your head every night, and you'll tell to your children and the other after. So that's why these stories were so powerful. They were not only containing information, they were also written up there and embedded with this kind of form of art and poesy. Okay. And I have like a lot of other stories. I'm short in time, so I'm gonna just mention quickly that, some of the stories, unfortunately, have been influenced by colonization. Why we lose this knowledge so quickly is that they were kind of forbidden for a very long time. People were not allowed to tell them. And there's even a version of a story that is very popular in Canada, I believe, Quebec a lot, that is called The Bewitched Canoe. You've never heard it? When I read it, I was like, oh my God, this is a version to make sure people wouldn't believe this canoe story, because there's, in the story, a canoe that is led by an evil person, probably the devil itself, that takes some men in a camp and make a deal with them that if they want to see their family for one night in the middle of the winter, they'd have to sell their soul to the devil and get into that ride with the canoe. And if ever they would touch like a church or a top or something, there was like a lot of different rules that they had to obey in the canoe. Unless they would do that, then their soul would go to the devil. So I believe that this version, this extreme version of a celestial canoe that is known by everybody, is kind of something to prevent people to share that story. So that canoes in the sky would be seen as something extremely negative. And I don't know the rest of the constellation yet. I'm still working on it. I believe that, like many other communities across Canada, the Innu community has a full stellar map with many, many constellations. but I need to dig more to find them. And it's by reading stories that I will do so, slowly but surely. And I think anybody can do that work, and being an astronomer helps me, because I know a lot of things that I can connect to, and I have an intuition to what kind of motion I can see in the sky and what it could represent in a story. So that's really helpful. And there are many other stories that talk about possible asteroids impacting the Earth. That's a good one, like where the tundra comes from, where a Mistapio is basically shooting an arrow in the sky, and then this gigantic goose, again, a goose is associated with the Milky Way, appears, and it's so loud that they have to put their hands on their head to not burst, and makes a huge boom, like a sonic boom, and it returns into its home in the sky. Anyway, I like those stories. We will never have like written or like drawings of those events, but having these stories still alive and being told is a proof that they could at least keep track of these events and keep them for a long period of time again. Which asteroid impact it is, we don't know. But they knew it was happening. And maybe supernovae, why not? When a supernovae explode in the sky? We hear so many different stories across the planet about that. So what it would look like in Canada in the story. So I found a couple, I was like looking for it. Okay, this, on this one I was working differently. I was like, there must be supernovae in the story. Where are they? And I found two stories. So that one I'm not as sure. maybe I'm pulling the strings here. But you remember I was telling you Tsakapesh is the moon. And Orion is Wolverine. So when the Crab Nebulae supernova exploded in the sky, it happened on the 5th of July, and this is the year, 1054. It was about midnight in Canada when it appeared. And it was right by the crescent moon, right there, very close to it. And so what would it look like? During the day, you'd still see it. So at midnight it appears, sun rise, you still see the star in the sky, even if the sun is there, it's so bright. And it stays visible even during the daytime for a month before it fades out and then becomes like almost indistinguishable in the sky. So that's for the picture of the constellation. You have Kwikwetchu, this is where the Crab Nebulae was. Okay, two options. This story is about Tsakapesh and the crow. He was poking at a fire, trying to keep the embers warm for cooking his caribou, and he had to go to sleep. Tsakapesh the moon had to go to sleep. He asked the crows to keep the fire alive for him. And the moon is 29 days and a half before it comes back. The supernova was visible in the sky for 27 days. When Tsakapesh comes back, the fire is dead. And he's not happy with the crow. He's telling him, you're going to stay dark for the rest of your life, and you're going to eat raw meat. And that's the end of the story. But isn't it just a story about why the crow are eating raw meat? Or is it something more? We will never know. There's also another story that I found appealing, because it also talks about a raven, a crow, but it's the wolverine this time that tries to steal the light from the midnight sky. It was just above the head of the wolverine in the sky. Is it something again that talks about this event that happened 1,000 years ago? We don't know. But what I know is that there's not 1,000 stories like this. There's just a few. Very intense coincidence that I could find these connections just by looking for a few minutes. Just saying, okay. And I'm going to say there's a lot of knowledge that comes from the weather and other science. Like, I always found interesting that weather information comes from the moon halos, how the stars twinkle. And as an astronomer, I've used that a lot. If there's a lot of turbulence and humidity in the sky, we will see the stars twinkle. The sunset colors associated with the humidity. Even the seasonal haze that comes and go related, again, to humidity. Aurora motion, how fast they move. And even kids' behavior. I mean, why not? And so there are even specific stories that are actually related to extremely highly technical aspect of physics. For instance, in the Ojibwe community, the Orion is the winter maker. It's also a paddler in a canoe. They use the three stars of the belt that aligns upwards towards the horizon, and they basically say, depending on their distances, the way they split with each other, you can tell the long-term weather forecast of a winter. And I don't know if it's true, but what I know is that the light coming from those stars when they are on the horizon goes across all of the layer of the atmosphere. And those stars have very specific colors, and there's a phenomenon that is called atmospheric refraction that depends on those colors. And then actually it will change the distance that you observe from those stars when they are on the horizon, depending on the density, the humidity, and what you find in the atmosphere. So were they able to read it? Maybe. When someone told me a story, I tried to think about the fact that it must be true, and I tried to find an explanation of why it could be true, instead of saying it's wrong. And that's something that really unlocks a lot of things and connections that I can make. And if you do the same, you might find connections. And as scientists, I believe you're all capable of keeping your mind open and finding those connections. And I'm doing a lot of projects currently in Canada. I've just been nominated as the chair of the Indigenous Engagement Committee for the Canadian Astronomical Society. I continue to do my own little project. This is the Astronomy with Indigenous People. We take kids from different schools across Quebec to the Momigansic Observatory. We talk about astronomy, about Indigenous astronomy. We try to trigger curiosity for them and interest them. During COVID, I gave probably 100 talks to the Connected North Initiative, which is basically organizing a seminar for teachers across the land, but mostly in remote communities. And anybody can volunteer for that. During the eclipse of 2021, I was able to tell stories about eclipses. And we translated them in 8 different native languages with subtitles, and we provided them to many, many communities along the path of totality. There's some there, if ever you're interested. We're going to do a similar project with the upcoming eclipse. I recently been featured in a documentary from the National Film Board of Canada, where they followed me in Hawaii, hunting, talking about my science, and also the blend between culture and science, and how important it is. It's 5 episodes, very short. It's aiming for high school students, and it's there for the teachers. I also participated in a planetarium project where we showcased different stories from different communities across the globe, and the Celestial Canoe is one of them. I've participated with people in Hawaii to ceremonies about the equinox and the sky. All of this started in 2017 with a simple question, and it just snowballed into this. And it could be similar for anybody. Now there's another eclipse coming, so for me, they're special. We're doing another little video project. We're going to talk about language, the meaning of eclipses, the meaning of the words in different communities across the path of totality. And that's something anybody could do, to do that work of trying to reconnect with that knowledge and share it with people, but also making content for the communities, for them to connect with astronomy. And I'm going to say thank you. Tanish Kumitin, mahalo.
Questions.
Did you learn something?
Yes.
Yes. So, yes.
Yeah, so speak into the mic.
Is this the mic here?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this. I myself, and I know a few other people here in Waterloo, are quite keen to do some kind of science and astronomy outreach. Yeah. Indigenous communities. You may have noticed that I'm a white British person. Do you have any kind of thoughts or advice on how to do this kind of thing sensitively?
Yeah. You know, these days with the reconciliation, there's a growing interest, right, in connecting and trying to create a new environment where communities can speak and can share, and that we can, you know, generate those interaction. And sometimes I hear from them that they are like almost overwhelmed with sometimes the number of requests that they get. I want to say, before you know going to community, you have to do a little bit of work on like educating yourself about the community that lives beside you. You can look at their land. You can look at the history of those lands. You can start to gather some information that you might find here and there. And then once you know a little bit, you go and ask them, oh, I've learned all of these things. Is it correct? And then can you tell me more? And just by doing this little, the first step of learning first, it prevents to basically give them the load of working, of giving you information and starting this. So that's what I think is a good strategy to start that, to educate yourself. And then the fact that you know all of this will probably be funny for them, like, because they're going to be like, wow, okay, you did some work, and they are going to appreciate it. Learning some words, a few words, what they mean. What's the typical, you know, character of a person from that community? They're all different. And I kind of wish you had seen that meeting we had 2 months ago with all of the different communities, because we had so many similarities, but also so many differences. And it was rich of these different cultures and different ways of seeing the sky. Some communities were more hunters, like mine. Others were more like settled for agriculture and corn. And well, it's, you know, the case around Toronto, I believe most of them were planting. And so just learning that, you know, those little things before you you start the connection. And then there's a lot of networks that are in place. In Ontario and different provinces is different, but try to reach out to them and get into their network. They will at least point you to the right person you can talk to and start projects. Yeah.
A comment and a question. The comment is that I come from the opposite side, in the sense that I made the opposite journey. I started to be curious about astronomy as a small child because of mythology. So in my family, nobody was a scientist. My mother knew about the classics. And so from hearing about those stories, I got curious about the science and the science of the world behind it. So this is about how powerful are narratives and how inspiring.
Yeah.
And this connects to the question that I wanted to ask you, because you stressed so many times these connections between art and science that was present. It was present in your traditional culture. It was present also in the old culture, European culture. And it got lost somehow. And now we are starting an era in which maybe we can explore this further.
Yeah.
So I wonder for you, since this is important, how do you see that you can foster this relation?
Yeah.
How can you do it in your work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One of the things also is the it's multi-disciplines. So you don't learn about astronomy without learning about ecology, biodiversity, environment, seasons, and all of this together. I think that when we teach a class, and I think that there's an effort right here to be interdisciplinary and to mix the different fields. I think we need to continue that, enhance that. And art is part of it. So we cannot be specialists in everything, but we can learn. And so by fostering collaborations with artists directly.
Do you have any?
Yeah, well, with some of the project, we work with some local artists from my community. Including the ones for the planetarium show. It's beautiful. All the rendering, anyway. The Celestial Canoe, by the way, it's free. You go on the oneskyproject.org. You can watch them. It's all free. And a lot of the renderings are made by local artists. And so it's like an exchange, you know, back and forth. And then we were looking at the motions of the constellation, and it was inspiring some of the design that they made for us. And That's an example. And there's also the music that goes with it, local music. And so I think that all of that makes the final product more complete. And people, when they go to the planetarium and see this, they can connect in so many different ways to it. It's just multi-facets, you know. And we have to take the full, to grasp, you know, the full impact that this has. It will convince some people to be interested into science that would have never been otherwise. And I've had some people telling me, like, I hate to hear about science. When I heard it was a science class, I was like, oh. And then I sat there and I saw this and I was amazed. And I got this reaction constantly. So we are going to reach out to more people. And why are we doing science if it's not to increase the knowledge of everybody? So if we are not able to trigger their interest and share that knowledge, we are really missing a point there, a very important one. So we have to work on this. Keep them interested, yeah.
Small comments. Yeah. Something that I really loved that is amazing in your work is that it's a demonstration that traditional culture and scientific culture should not, they are not in a dichotomy in which they...
Yeah, totally. They inspire.
Yeah.
And in our work, there is a lot about science intuition, and it is affected by your culture, your way of seeing the world. And I always tell people, because I've been always asked, you know, people are like comparing like science, First Nation science to modern science. And it's not a comparison that is fair because it was stopped and kind of tried to be extinguished for so long. But if you go back 400 years ago and you start from the premise that we come from the stars, would we have learned more about star formation faster? Anyway, I don't know that answer, but I have my own my own perspective on it. Yeah. There is, yeah. Yeah, protests, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I grew so much during those 6 years because I arrived there thinking there would be a lot of similarity. I had to understand, you know, the community there. They are also in the US setup, which is different in Canada. So there's so many like political, social, cultural aspects that I had to learn. And then the history of science on Wanamanakea and the telescopes, I had to go back in time and try to gather information about that. And what I want to say, you know, is that those protests that happened for the building of the 30-meter telescope, a large facility on the summit of Wanamanakea, were triggered by something that was kind of always awakened there for a very long time. Even when telescopes started to be built 40 years ago, there was some protests about it, but back in those days, we didn't have like Facebook or Twitter. Nobody knew what was going on there. But it was happening. Maybe not to that scale, because also they were able to organize themselves and have more power and have a greater voice. And now everybody heard about it and knew about it. And what I see is that, well, first of all, there's no telescope yet. And things are changing. So for a period of time, the first few years, I felt like I was in between two worlds, because I love astronomy, but I also understood them so deeply. And we have similar protests in Canada, not for telescopes, but for other things. And it's all about having the right to say what's going on your land and being consulted. And everybody has heard about that. And if you do it right, it doesn't mean that there's not going to be any telescopes on the Manakea. It just means that it will be different. It will be well taught. It will include more things. And I believe that what happened will change things. And it changed me. It changed other people. You ask the question, it's probably like something that is now important for you to do science and thinking about culture and how it affects the community. So all those scientists that nowadays have this new knowledge will do science differently. So I have good hope that we will make good use of that information, yeah, and be more sensitive about it.
Burning question, or shall we go get some snacks? I think any other questions we can discuss out in the bistro.
Thank you.